We have two cases on our 9 o'clock docket. Then we'll take a short recess and readjourn for our one case on our 10:30 docket this morning. The first case is Harrison versus BNSF. If the clerk will please announce counsel who will be arguing. All right, Mr. Major.
May it please the court. Courts are not allowed to cut down FELA protections by mere inference or implication, but that's exactly what the trial court judgment has done here. This is a FELA case based in part on BNSF's use of oversized ballasts in areas of high foot traffic by their employees. Now, the trial court granted summary judgment on BNSF's preclusion defense. Now, that judgment should be reversed for three reasons. Number one, the trial court applied the wrong standard. Number two, regardless of what standard the trial court applied, the evidence did not conclusively establish BNSF's preclusion defense. And then three, the trial court granted more relief than what was requested by BNSF by dismissing claims unattacked by BNSF. Now today, I really just want to focus on two things. Number one, the proper standard, and with a real emphasis today on the least stringent standard, which is the true preemption standard, like you would normally get in a conflict between a federal law and a state law. And the reason I want to emphasize that is to show that even under this least stringent standard, there's no preclusion here. The second thing I want to focus on is the Sixth Circuit's holding in Nichols, and I want to demonstrate how they got it wrong in several ways. Now, as you've undoubtedly read from our brief, we support a true preclusion standard here. We have FELA and we have FERSA, two federal statutes, and there's years of precedent in the United States Supreme Court holding that when you have two federal statutes that potentially conflict, courts should try their best to read those two statutes and apply those two statutes together, unless there's an irreconcilable conflict between the two. Now here, FELA sections 51 through 54A demonstrates that Congress actually contemplated cases where the conduct at issue complied with FERSA. That's briefed rather heavily in our briefing. Also, section 20103 of FERSA expressly states that FERSA is meant to supplement pre-existing federal law such as FELA. Now, if the court is not inclined to apply the true preclusion standard, we have alternatively argued that the standard voiced in MOPAC 1 and 2 and then applied in Hendricks by the Houston Court of Appeals should apply. Now there, the MOPAC court, which was the Fifth Circuit, the MOPAC court dealt with a Texas state regulation that would require a walkway that would both sit atop and adjoin the railroad, the roadbed. So it was undisputed that the FERSA ballast regulation was triggered and other related roadbed regulations. So MOPAC dealt with a law that would certainly touch upon the roadbed, as this case does. The Fifth Circuit didn't just automatically hold that state law regulation was preempted. It went through an analysis, and at the end of the day, it found preemption could lie in one of two circumstances. First, the court held that the railroad could show preemption by demonstrating that they must enlarge or strengthen the roadbed beyond FERSA regulations requirements. That would be one way that the court would find preemption. The second way would be if the railroad could show that the state law regulation actually required them to do something in contravention of the FERSA regulation. Now, if the court is not inclined to apply either of those first two standards and decides to choose the preemption standard, which applies to conflicts between federal law and state law, I want to discuss, and this is where the bulk of my argument is today, I want to discuss why Mr. Harrison's claims are not even precluded under that standard. And to do that, We really need to talk about Easterwood and Shanklin, two United States Supreme Court cases. Those courts held this, that when a FERSA regulation substantially subsumes the subject matter of a state law claim, then that state law claim is preempted. So the key phrasing there is substantially subsumes. Undoubtedly, you've seen it in our briefing. It appears and reappears often. Now, just what does Easterwood and Shanklin mean by substantially subsumes? Now, Easterwood and Shanklin were both very careful to define what substantially subsumes doesn't mean. It doesn't mean to merely touch upon, and it doesn't mean to merely relate to. It means something else. It means something much more. Now, in Easterwood, the court dealt with a case arising from a railroad crossing collision between a private automobile and a locomotive. Now, there were two claims there. There were state law claims. One was for excessive speed, and the other was for inadequate warning devices. Now, the Easterwood court held that the warning device regulations actually kind of related to the subject matter of that case, but didn't find preemption. But more important to our analysis today is the Easterwood court's addressing the speed-related claim. It considered the FERSA speed regulation, which sets maximum speed limits for trains on a given level of track. And the plaintiffs argued, well, this FERSA regulation only sets a maximum limit, so it only sets a minimum standard of care. The court considered all the hazards that could give rise to a collision at this railroad crossing. And it determined that the Secretary of Transportation, in promulgating this FERSA speed regulation, actually considered all the hazards at issue on that day of the collision. And because the Secretary of Transportation had considered those hazards, the court found that the FERSA regulation didn't just establish a maximum speed, it was sort of a predetermination of what was reasonable. And so upon that finding, it held that the FERSA speed regulation substantially subsumed the subject matter of that case, that is, the excessive speed or the train speed. Now here, the hazard at issue are those hazards that give rise to railroad employees falling on oversized ballast and other issues with ballast. The ballast regulation itself demonstrates that hazards associated with employees' falls have not been considered. It's completely silent on anything employee-related or ballast size-related. In fact, its express focus is on the track structure, not on hazards associated with employee falls. So under Easterwood, there is no preemption. And if there's no preemption, there can certainly be no preclusion. Now, Shanklin deals with another FERSA regulation. Shanklin, like Easterwood, deals with a collision between a private automobile and a locomotive at a railroad crossing. Now, there, the relevant claim was based on the adequacy of the warning devices at the crossing. Now, the court ultimately held that in this case, because the FERSA regulation, because the federal government had both funded and approved the warning devices under the FERSA regulation, that regulation substantially subsumed the subject matter of the claim, that is, the adequacy of those warning devices. Now, here's the key language in Shanklin. The key language in Shanklin is this. Once the federal government funds and approves warning devices, it, quote, it displaces private decision-making authority by establishing a federal law requirement. And I'm going to repeat that. Some of that is paraphrased, some of it is quoted. Once the federal government funds and approves warning devices, it displaces private decision-making authority. Now here, with the ballast regulation, BNSF concedes and even argues that its decision-making authority is not displaced. It argues that under the ballast regulation, it is afforded substantial discretion. So unlike the reasoning in Shanklin, there is no displacement of BNSF's decision-making authority with respect to what ballast to use, especially in the context of employee safety. So just to recap, our position is that the true preclusion standard should apply. Alternatively, we argue that the MOPAC standard should apply. And finally, even if the preemption standard were to apply, BNSF cannot establish preclusion under Easterwood because it can't show that in promulgating the ballast regulation, the Secretary of Transportation considered the hazards that give rise to employees' falls. Nor can it argue that the ballast is some kind of predetermination of what is reasonable, especially in the context of employee falls. Finally, there's no preemption or preclusion under Shanklin because BNSF cannot show that the ballast regulation displaces its private decision-making authority in deciding what type of ballast to use. Now there are, switching gears a little bit to the Nichols Court and to the Fifth and Seventh Circuit Court opinions that hold that some FELA claims can be precluded by FERSA. Note that in Waymire and Lane, the Seventh Circuit and Fifth Circuit respectively held that certain FELA claims based on speed, on train speed, can be precluded when the train was complying with the FERSA speed regulation. Waymire, like Shanklin, or similar to Shanklin, held that some FELA claims based on the inadequacy of warning devices may be precluded when those warning devices are federally funded and federally approved. Nichols held that FELA claims based on oversized ballast that cause employees to fall are precluded. But I want to talk about the numerous ways that Nichols gets it wrong. Number one, all three of these courts relied on the idea of uniformity. Now, Section 20106 under FERSA is the preemption statute. It states that its goal for uniformity is only applicable to the extent that uniformity is practicable. Now, BNSF, in its briefing, has argued that due to local conditions of tracks, it is impossible to uniformly regulate ballast. So it was an error for Nichols to rely on the idea of uniformity, at least under this ballast regulation.
Mr. Major, how does your approach encourage or increase or even serve the purpose of uniformity if all 50 states can have a different interpretation of what is to be a negligent act in terms of the size of the ballast?
Well, under FELA, the negligent standard is uniform across the nation. And so to the extent that uniformity, any degree of uniformity is possible, applying FELA the way it is written will make the cases as uniformly applied as possible.
But it all comes down to the fact questions in each case, doesn't it?
Well, but look at it the other way. If you, let's say, if you apply preclusion to a ballast claim, then the same finding of whether you comply with the ballast regulation is going to differ from court to court to court. At the very least, under any standard, you have to show that you complied with the ballast regulation. And due to the language of the ballast regulation and this so-called discretion that a railroad can use in dropping ballast on a track, the findings of preclusion are going to differ from case to case as well. Now, FELA actually incorporates FERSA regulations in Section 54A, I believe, and Section 53. It states that when the railroad fails to comply with a relevant FERSA regulation, that it no longer has its comparative fault defense. So Congress has actually already thought about this issue, and they've balanced your concern, I think, and have decided that we allow the FELA standards, the uniform FELA standards, to govern. Now, Nichols got it wrong in several other respects as well. It didn't really discuss Easterwood and didn't really discuss how the definition of substantially subsumes applies to the ballast regulation. It didn't really apply it certainly didn't apply the true preclusion standard. It did not address, and I'm not sure that it was brought to their attention in their defense, 20103, where it states, in section 20103, where it states that FERSA must supplement pre-existing federal law, such as FELA, I don't know that it addressed it. And because FERSA it only supplements FELA, then it can't displace it. The Nichols Court did not acknowledge or apply the Fifth Circuit's standard in MOPAC. And without citing any authority whatsoever, Nichols just simply equates, it just holds, hey, the railroad has discretion under the ballast regulation, so it must preempt claims based on ballast size. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Major. Mr. Wolf.
The court. Good morning. Jeffrey Wolf on behalf of BNSF Railway. I think that this is a factually simple case, and I hope through this argument to show you that it's a legally simple case as well. We had a gentleman, Mr. Harrison, who stepped off of a locomotive out in the Becker Siding near Clovis, New Mexico. He stepped right onto the roadbed. That's the area of the ballast that you see sloped, and I think there's even pictures in the record. He stepped onto the ballast, and because he said there was a large rock there, he says that the railroad is negligent. I think that you have indicated, Judge Meyer, that that's going to create a standard that anywhere you may have a large piece of ballast that gives way and an employee slips, he's going to have an FELA claim. Or if there's someplace else where there's a smaller piece of ballast, the employee can argue it's too small and argue that he has an FELA claim. So we need to have a uniform standard, and that is what I think Congress intended. And I want to talk briefly about Congress's intent because I think that's the starting point in our analysis. And if you look at the current version of the statute, the first thing that it talks about is national uniformity of regulation. It says laws, regulations, and orders related to railroad safety and laws, regulations, and orders related to railroad security, that was a new amendment, shall be nationally uniform to the extent practicable. So we need to have, according to Congress, a uniform national standard. Are we changing the FELA by saying that the FRSA creates the railroad's duty? No. The FELA standard remains the same. You still have to prove a breach of duty, and then you have this wonderful producing cause standard that is part of the FELA, and then they have to prove their damages. The elements of the FELA claim remain the same. What we have here is you've got to look at two different statutory schemes. Under the FELA, you have a tort compensation system for railroad workers. The FRSA, on the other hand, are railroad safety statutes, which were adopted by the Secretary of Transportation, and they're administered by the Federal Railroad Administration to provide safety in every aspect of railroads. That includes employee safety. Interestingly, and we've cited some of the legislative history of the FRSA, there was an intent that labor, including the plaintiff's bar, be involved in the statute. Not only the first time that the statutes and regulations were considered, but more recently, after Nichols, and after all the great case law that we have cited to this court that says that there is preclusion of the FELA in this instance. So, labor's had input, that is, the workers themselves have had input into the current state of the law. So let's talk about the different standards that they've advanced and whether they should be applicable to a case like this. The first argument that I heard advanced was we have to have a true preclusion standard, which is this irreconcilable conflict. I think there is that's directly addressed in the Nichols case. That language isn't in the statute, says the Nichols court. Therefore, it's not a part of the analysis for preclusion, and every court that has looked at the issue since Nichols has used the Nichols standard. There are three primary cases that I think have been cited, the High Circuit Court appeals, and we're looking at a matter of federal law with the FELA in this case. We have Waymire, we have Lane in the Fifth Circuit, and we have Nichols in the Sixth Circuit. Nichols deals directly with the issues in this case. I enjoy being a historian of law, and I organized that I would understand them better for purposes of today's argument. But as I was historically going through the cases, one of the early cases was a case called Earwood. Earwood was back in 1993. It's a district court decision down in Georgia. It dealt with train speed and crossing devices, cases that were displaced by Waymire and Lane. It is the only case that uses the irreconcilable conflict standard, and it is perhaps the most criticized railroad case on the books. If you go on to Westlaw, you'll see it's been distinguished and criticized more times than I think any other railroad case that exists. And then you go through a series of cases that come to the point of MOPAC 1 and MOPAC 2, which are the Fifth Circuit cases, the first to address the issue of preclusion in the context of a state requirement for walkways along railroads. Now, what we find out as we look at MOPAC and we look at the other cases, one of the cases I think they cite is the Box case out of the Seventh Circuit. It's an interesting case written by, I believe it's Easterbrook. Judge Easterbrook says in that case, walkways, the FRA had a policy statement, and the FRA says we're not going to regulate walkways for employees. Walkways are the areas built alongside tracks or down below the tracks where employees walk. It's not the roadbed where the train sits. It's not where Mr. Harrison got off the train in this case. And so I think consistent with the FRA's own policy statement, the Fifth Circuit says, well, the only way that you can have preemption when you're talking about walkways is if you're affecting the roadbed, and that's the area where Mr. Harrison was in this case. So that standard really doesn't apply. Hendricks was a similar case. The Court of Appeals down in Houston, it was big rock ballast like we have here, except instead of being on the track roadbed or the area that supports the track, it was down in the yard walkways. I think you've probably seen Centennial Yard and the other yards. Fort Worth's got a lot of yards. Those yards have walkway areas for the employees, and out in the middle of the railroad, there were big chunks of ballast, and people would trip over them. And so that's what was addressed in Hendricks. And since the court even says, since it was outside the area of the roadbed supporting the track structure, evidence was required that the railroad would need to strengthen and enlarge the roadbed beyond the FRSA requirements. So they're recognizing that if you're away from the roadbed, that's the standard you apply. But in this case, we're dealing with the actual roadbed itself, the support structure for the track, because that's what the train was sitting on. He's coming off of the locomotive, stepping down onto the roadbed. Now, there's a footnote in my brief, and I want to point this out because I do think it's important factually. BNSF had built 60 yards a little bit further down the track a nice dismount area for all of its employees to park their locomotives. For whatever reason, Mr. Harrison chose not to use that area. Instead, he chose to dismount on the track roadbed. So what is the standard for the track roadbed? Again, I think that these FRSA ballast regulations and what they're focused on, and let's talk about the uniformity that's demanded by those regulations, they demand that the track be maintained at a particular level. Now, why is that important? Could you imagine a train going down the track sideways? And does that not affect employee safety and the folks that are operating the train? It requires that the track have good drainage. Could you imagine a big rain coming along and what happens to the track? There's an abundance of claims these days of, in FELA cases of trains bottoming out because of washouts and things like that. So if you don't use the right kind of ballast for the particular location, then you're going to have those kinds of issues. And so the regulation requires that the railroad design, build, and maintain the track roadbed in a particular way. And the FRA inspects, and it's part of its jurisdiction to inspect, to make sure that that roadbed does exactly what is required by the FRSA regulations.
But what about the fact that the, I think it's 213.103, where it lists the types of factors that they're supposed to consider in the roadbed, it doesn't say anything about a safe step-off place or anything about employee safety. It talks about really the structural integrity of the roadbed.
And I think that goes to the issue of when do you have preclusion in a case like this? Is the area where the employee is stepping, that is the roadbed, covered or substantially assumed by the regulations? And the courts since Nichols have almost uniformly held that's the case. And I would commend to you, there is perhaps the most recent opinion is the Pitts case. The High Court, I believe it is in Maryland, considered the issue, and it's the second time that a Maryland court, or third time a Maryland court has considered the issue. It was just decided in February. And it talks about 213.103, the section that you just mentioned, Your Honor, how it substantially subsumes any FELA claim based on ballast that is performing a track support function. That's where Mr. Harrison stepped in this case. The court goes on to say that if there's a complaint about walkway areas, that is the areas that the railroad has for its employees to walk as opposed to the areas that support the track, that is not substantially subsumed by the FRSA regulations. And so I think it comes down to a question of location to ultimately decide these cases. Where is the employee claiming that his injury occurred?
Doesn't that become then a fact question?
In this case, it doesn't, because he stepped immediately off the locomotive onto the ballast that supported the track. In these other cases, it's undisputed that that's the case here. In other cases, for example, the employee was on a walkway, that is away from the area where the track support and the roadbed was at. And in those cases, they say there's no preclusion, and that you can still have a FELA claim. And you can still have a FELA claim even on the roadbed, but what they have in their burden of proof to show a duty, we're not taking away an FELA claim by saying that the FRSA provides the duty. They've got to show that the railroad's noncompliance with that duty or that standard established by the FRSA then causes the violation of the FRSA, which gives rise to the claim. So we're not taking away an FELA claim. We're just defining duty through the FRSA.
Isn't there a difference between these cases where there is some discretion of the railroad? By your own hypothetical, you talked about two locations, one where there's large rock ballast and one where there's small ballast. These other cases where we've talked about warning devices and speed, that's the same everywhere. These are tailored to the location to give the proper support and varies from location to location.
Actually, from location to location, the track is built to the standards necessary for the geographic conditions. For example, a track is built, you ought to see the large ballast, for example, out in Colorado as you go through the mountain passes. But in response to your question, the railroad determines how the track is going to be built according to these standards. There are different classes of track. The class of the track then determines the track speed, and track speed varies from location to location depending upon the design and maintenance standards. So it's the same standards that apply to the speed.
That's not really. If you know that this is a certain class of track, you can only go X miles an hour. There's nothing that I'm aware of in any of these standards that say if the slope is this, you have to use this size ballast. It's discretionary with who is designing it at the location.
Well, I think the Nichols Court said it best. If you look at all those different things that are regulated by the ballast regulations, they determine what kind of ballast, what the reasonable size of the ballast is for the particular location. What's going to be important, looking at this issue of national uniformity, Your Honor, is that the FRA is making sure that these tracks are built structurally correct so that trains can safely travel over them. That's an employee safety issue. Now, as to other areas of track, for example, where there might be a crew pad, where there might be a walkway, the FRA isn't regulating those areas. Instead, we have a clearly regulated area here, which is substantially assumed and covered by the regulations. I think that's the distinction. I was also making the point about location, location, location. Where is the employee stepping? Pitts draws a distinction between, is it one of these two areas? Is it the roadbed or is it a walkway? The other case that does that is the Libran case, which is a case that, it's a newer case that addresses one of the cases that the plaintiffs had cited, which I believe was the Davis case. It really overrules Davis, but what it says is an FELA claim regarding the area immediately adjoining the track, which is what we have here, is precluded where the ballast is performing the functions required by Section 213. The Kressel Court, same thing. In fact, the court even says preclusion turns on whether the ballasted issue was track-supporting ballast. If it's track-supporting ballast, the point is the railroad needs to make sure so that the track will meet those support functions and meet the FRA requirements so that it will pass the FRA's inspections for the safe passage of trains. The McCain case as well out of Pennsylvania. So I told you I was sort of a historian looking at these cases. The only case that I think goes to the contrary, some of these earlier cases, are really before Nichols. And if you take a hard look at the law since Nichols, which was decided by the Sixth Circuit in March of 2009, you've got Munns in the Northern District of Ohio following Nichols. You've got McCain in Pennsylvania. You've got Kressel in Minnesota. You've got Cowden in the Eighth Circuit following the Sixth Circuit. You've got Librand in the Eastern District of Arkansas following that case. And you've got CSX versus Pitts, the High Court in Maryland. And I think when we're talking about national uniformity, I would urge that this court should follow the nationally uniform standard that other courts have adopted. And that is the standard that there is preclusion when you're stepping onto ballast that is supporting the roadbed.
Mr. Wolf, I know your time's expired, but are you familiar with any railroad ballast anywhere in the country, or any case involving any railroad ballast that has been that has used radioactive or razor sharp ballast in areas where employees walk?
I can tell you this, Your Honor. I've been doing railroad work since the early 90s. I've been on railroad tracks probably in every part of the western United States. I don't believe I've ever seen anything that was sharp or radioactive out there. I think that hypothetical is beyond the pale.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you, Mr. Wolf. Mr. Major, rebuttal.
I want to start by talking a little bit more about uniformity. I think that the idea of uniformity is really the sole basis of preclusion here. It's what I really sense from the briefing and from the argument. And the United States Supreme Court recently, I think in 2012, or maybe 2002, in Spreitzma, dealt with a similar goal of uniformity under the Federal Boat Safety Act. And ultimately, the court found itself deciding, similarly here, well, let me just back up a little bit. The Federal Boating Safety Act, the regulations thereunder, did not provide for propeller guards on outboard motors. And in that case, the plaintiff, was injured, and I think even killed, by a boat propeller. And the Coast Guard, who actually promulgated the regulations, had studied the issue for 18 months and had purposefully decided not to require these propeller guards on these boats. And so when there was a lawsuit brought based on the lack of propeller guard, the defendant argued that the claim was preempted because of the Coast Guard's obvious decision to intentionally omit the regulation. So the court found itself deciding whether uniformity alone could support preemption. And on the last page of that opinion, it states, look, the main goal of the FBSA is boat safety. The secondary goal, and it was expressed, there was an express goal of uniformity in that regulation at issue. The secondary goal is uniformity. Now here, under Section 20106, FERSA states its secondary goal of uniformity. Uniformity to the extent practicable. Under Section 20101, it states its primary goal. And that is railroad safety. And it states it again in 49 U.S.C. Section 103, which I think I failed to cite in my briefing. 49 U.S.C. 103 really emphasizes that the goal of FERSA and the Secretary of Transportation is safety. Under Spreitzma, when the basis for preclusion rests on uniformity and uniformity alone, then it must, the idea and interest of uniformity must yield to the primary goal of safety. I also want to address a little bit about the Justice Livingston, I think you mentioned something about a fact issue, or maybe Justice Gabriel. I would disagree that it is undisputed that Mr. Harrison stepped on the roadbed. That, I don't think, was conclusively established by the evidence. I don't think it was before the court in the second motion for summary judgment. In fact, I think on page 119 of the clerk's record, is just one indication that at least BNSF may have thought that this area was a walkway. There's an email where BNSF's own expert, Dennis Mirabal, I'm sure you've seen his name in the briefing, he refers to this area as a walkway. So I don't think it's undisputed that this area was on the roadbed. Plus, I don't know if you've seen it yet, but there was an amicus brief submitted yesterday. And it shows the practical dimensions of a locomotive and how the overhang of the locomotive would put an engineer stepping off the locomotive off the roadbed. And to be honest with you, I don't know anything about locomotive dimensions, but it certainly supports the idea that there's a fact issue as to whether he actually stepped on a roadbed or what should have been a walkway. Now, it is true that the legislative history of FERSA indicates that there is a goal of uniformity. Now, beyond the Spreitzma holding and beyond earlier the fact that uniformity is not practicable here, the legislative history and congressional intent really is unnecessary here. The United States Supreme Court and courts all across the country have always held that when a statute is unambiguous, Congress means what it says and says what it means. And here, Section 20106 says exactly what it means, that uniformity is only a goal if it's practicable. 20103 says what it means and means what it says, that FERSA was meant to supplement FELA and other federal law. Now, as for the preclusion standard and whether it was ever applied in the FELA-FERSA context, we did cite cases in our briefing, including Grog versus CSX, and maybe even a couple other cases that use this irreconcilable conflict language to describe the analysis and standard. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, Mr. Major, Mr. Wolf, and other counsel that are here today. We appreciate you being here to present your arguments. We also appreciate all your briefing in this matter. Your case is now submitted, and you are excused. We will proceed to case number.